Hello, and thank you for joining me on the Frontier Markets Podcast. Today's guest is Ronald Phillip. Ronald Phillip is an international business leader with over two decades of global experience in strategy, investment, and consulting in the real estate and infrastructure sectors. He spent the last 20 years working on some fundamental infrastructure projects within emerging markets at several leading organizations, including McKinsey, PwC, the World Economic Forum, and the World Bank. He currently heads strategy for the largest developer of industrial real estate within the Middle East and Africa, Agility Logistics Parks. Without further delay, let's begin. Ronald, you've had an incredibly interesting and varied life and career that's cut across many continents, sectors, and companies. Would you be able to share some of the kind of highlights and common threads from that time over the last 20, 30 years?
Thanks for having me on your podcast, Krish. Krish, I'm someone from the emerging markets who's deeply passionate about working and having impact in the emerging markets. As you mentioned, I've spent the last two decades working on transport infrastructure and real estate in the emerging markets, particularly in the Middle East, Africa, and India. And what's driven me to do that has been a sense of adventure and a deep sense of purpose to improve lives through better infrastructure and real estate. Now, I grew up in a copper mining township in Zambia. It was a very idyllic childhood. I enjoyed sports, theater, and playing football in my lawn with my Zambian neighbors. When I was 11, I won a scholarship to boarding school in England. And that was a very transformational experience. It was a very international school. I did lots of theater and I played hockey. And then at the age of 13, my parents decided that they wanted to move back to India, which is where we're from. So I continued in boarding school in Bangalore. This was in the 90s when the city was beginning to grow rapidly with the IT boom. Again, I continued. I did more outside the classroom than inside the classroom. I did theater. I played hockey. I went on to become head boy. And I wanted to do liberal arts after that, you know, either read English or study law. But, you know, coming from a middle-class Indian background, typically, we at that point of time, and possibly now, we were given three choices, which was engineering, medicine, my mom is a doctor, or accounting, my dad's a chartered accountant. I didn't want to do any of them, but I eventually had to study engineering. And again, I spent most of my time outside the classroom doing a lot of theater and a student organization called ISEC. So, I mean, this was engineering school in Bangalore, and most people would end up, or their dream job was to start with a tech company in Bangalore, either the homegrown giants, Infosys, or Wipro, or one of the international tech giants. But I managed to start my career with the World Bank, evaluating projects around the world and evaluating their performance. A whole bunch of projects around the world, ranging from the Chad-Cameroon pipeline to projects in forests in India. And it was a fascinating experience for me, especially when I got to go into the field, because I saw poverty up close and really understood what worked and what didn't work. And that was when I was at the World Bank, where I was exposed to the work of the World Bank's private sector lending arm, the IFC. And I had two clear options after that. One was to try and do a PhD in economics and join the main, World Bank, or go to business school and work in private sector development, which was similar to the IFC, which is the bank's private sector lending arm. So I then went to business school. I went to one of India's elite business schools, the Indian Institutes of Management, where I fell in love with infrastructure finance and project finance. And I joined GE Capital after business school. And I wanted to double down on infrastructure. So PwC at the time had an infrastructure practice, which did a lot of public-private partnerships, a lot of feasibility for infrastructure projects. So I spent 2 years with them. And the crazy thing, Krish, is that most of my projects, big, ambitious, hairy infrastructure projects in South Asia, did not work out. So I was in Bangladesh for half a year working on a restructuring of Bangladesh Railways for the Asian Development Bank when the army overthrew the government. There was a coup and, you know, our project had to be cancelled. I worked on a large special economic zone in the state of West Bengal. And again, the project was signed, the financial model was fabulous, it worked out. But then after we signed the agreement with the state government, a large I mean, a very powerful local politician protested against the low price that we're paying for land acquisition. There were riots, the army was called in, people died, and the project was called off. So I realized that I had an inadequate toolkit for figuring out how to build infrastructure in the developing world. That's when I decided I needed to go back to school. So I went to Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, where I focused on infrastructure policy and development, but I had a much broader liberal arts education. Harvard Kennedy School attracts a wide spectrum of people from around the world who want to go on to become heads of state, leaders of the World Bank and international organizations, like alumni of ours who are heads of state and at the time were heads of the World Bank and IMF. And a whole bunch of people also want to have impact in the private sector, in sectors like energy, transport, healthcare, where you need to really understand government policy and regulation. So I had two incredible years at Harvard, where I even did summer internships with the mayor's office in Los Angeles, working on their clean tech policy, and in Jacksonville, Florida, where I worked with a railroad. And after the Kennedy School, I joined the World Economic Forum in their New York office. And this was a fascinating organization, very international in terms of what they did, but also my colleagues, very eclectic colleagues with a wide bunch of interests. So I was a global leadership fellow at the World Economic Forum, co-managing the logistics and transport industry program. And that was where we brought a whole bunch of companies from the logistics and transport sector, along with governments, to take action on enabling trade, reducing trade barriers, trying to understand how we could enable manufacturing in different parts of the world. So after 3 years at the World Economic Forum, I decided I wanted to go back into the private sector, and I joined McKinsey's global infrastructure practice in the US. And my dad was terminally ill in India, so I asked McKinsey whether I could shift into one of the emerging market offices, either Singapore or Dubai. And they said, sure, I mean, we have so much going on in the Middle East. Why don't you spend a year in Dubai? So I came to Dubai for what was meant to be a year, but of course I've stayed on now for 11. And for 6 years with McKinsey in the Middle East, I served a wide range of transport ministers, top sovereign wealth funds, working on incredibly exciting transformational projects from new cities to new ports. Most of them are confidential, but one of them is public information. I worked on the Nicaragua Canal, the feasibility for the Nicaragua Canal, which was conceived and meant to be a rival to the Panama Canal. So incredibly exciting stuff with a whole bunch of very smart colleagues and clients who really wanted a solution for some very big problems that they were facing or challenges they're facing. After 6 years at McKinsey, I wanted to get my hands dirty and actually implement some of the strategy work that I had been doing. So I joined an emerging markets conglomerate called Agility, which is headquartered in the Middle East. I joined as head of strategy for their large warehousing business, which has a footprint across the Middle East, Africa, and India. And since I joined in 2019, I've been working on their expansion across these markets, trying to figure out which new countries we add, what new asset classes we enter. So one of them was data centers, and I built out the new data center vertical for Agility. And we've also looked at what kind of partnerships we'd have in these countries, either on the operating side or on the capital side. So that's long-winded and curvy adventure through the last through many countries and continents over my lifetime thus far.
Wonderful. I feel like you have seen an immense amount, and as you kind of mentioned before, it does feel somewhat unfortunate that because of NDAs, we can't get into the nitty-gritty of some of these things. But I am very excited to dig deeper on what we can dig deeper on. And one thing in particular that I wanted to kind of ask you about here is you mentioned the going back to school to kind of like develop your toolkit, right? I'm just very curious about how your view on what it takes to be a successful operator and builder of infrastructure has evolved in those 20 years.
Yeah. I think it's a fairly complex answer, but I think you have to be very grounded in what works in the context, because I've now done business in so many countries across Africa, across the Middle East, and even within different states in India. And context matters, and understanding that context in detail matters, the political context, the economic context for that market. The solution for any problem might be different changing on depending on context. And your strategy that you develop needs to be unique for that context. What we've realized and what I've learned over the last 20 years is that what's worked in one market may not work in another. And if you're developing a product, it needs to be specific for that market. The other thing I've learned is that human relationships matter in these situations. So a contract is often an important piece of paper, but you live with Murphy's Law all the time in emerging markets. And when Murphy's Law hits, there's the contract, but most of the time, figuring out a solution is a function of relationships. And that's why building relationships in emerging markets really matters. I find that sometimes in the West, there isn't that much focus on building the relationships, and you count on the contract. In emerging markets, I'd say you have to focus heavily on relationships, building them and maintaining them over a very long period of time, because they compound in how powerful and important they become.
Okay, I love that. One kind of micro anecdote here I think you may like is Brookfield Asset Management, when they went to India, they spent 5 years developing relationships and trying to understand the local context before they even invested in a single project, right? Because you need to know not just, oh, what does, for example, a lease purchase agreement look like within this region from a kind of contractual standpoint, but you also want to kind of more deeply know what does the kind of social fabric of kind of enforcement look like in some sense as well. So I think that's fascinating. Now, you've highlighted two main threads in your professional career: transport infrastructure and real estate. Perhaps we can dive into the first. What is your take on the build out of transport infrastructure more broadly within emerging markets?
Sure, Krish. Krish, there's a massive build out of transport infrastructure across the emerging markets. There's a huge undersupply. And I've worked on this for 20 years in India, the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE in particular, and across multiple African countries. I'll maybe start with India, because 20 years back, they started building an entire program of national highways. They started privatizing a lot of transport assets. They did the first privatizations of Delhi and Mumbai Airport, and they started to bring a model that it was quite common in the West, which was the public-private partnership, where you'd have a concession agreement for 30 years with a government entity, and they would be your partner in a concession. Sometimes the government would be a 26% shareholder and the private player would be 75%. So when I was at PwC, I worked on structuring a lot of these public-private partnerships for toll road projects, for different types of assets. And this was fascinating because government entities had never partnered with the private sector before. They had looked to give contracts to the private sector, right? And they managed those contracts, but they'd never been a partner for a 30-year period. So imagine you'd have to, a lot of private companies were now bidding for these partnerships with the government. And the first challenge in the business case is, what do we forecast the number of air passengers for Bangalore is going to be if there's a new airport? What is the forecast for how many cars there's going to be on this brand new bridge between Delhi and a neighboring suburb? Interesting thing, Krish, is that all those forecasts have mostly been blown out of the water, right? Because the forecast for any of those airports, if you plan to hit a number, say 2 million passengers in 30 years, what's happened in India is you've hit that in 15 years. Wow. You know, so the demand expectations have been even more ambitious in real life than we ever forecasted in that market. But the problems that we had there, which I've seen throughout my life, have been the challenge of land acquisition. Because what happens is that there's only so much land in any of these countries, and there are people living on that, and they often don't have title to them, but they're poor people. So you need to move them in some sort of process that is fair and equitable and reasonable to them. So land acquisition has been the bane of infrastructure development in India, but across most of the markets that I've worked on. So India has seen a huge build out in transport infrastructure. I saw that at the dawn of this 20 years back, and it's continued. It has highways, it's improving its ports, because it's realized that transport infrastructure has increased the cost of logistics, which has been a tax on doing business and manufacturing in India. So I think this will continue. I mean, I was in the brand new Bangalore airport, the new terminal in Bangalore, Krish, and it's a public-private partnership with the Airports Authority of India and a private consortium that had Siemens and a big local developer called GMR. And it's easily one of the best airports that I've been to. It reminds you of Changi in Singapore. But that is the success of the PPP model in India, that the private sector has been able to partner with the government in delivering world-class transport infrastructure. And I think there's a lot to learn for the rest of the developing world in what has worked and what hasn't worked. You know, I was on holiday in Zanzibar last year, and I traveled to a lot of African countries as a tourist and for business. And sometimes it strikes me, can't they do a concession with this airport? So it turns out to be a better airport and better infrastructure, which will attract more flights and therefore more tourism in some of these cities. So I think there's a lot to learn from the India piece. If I shift to the Middle East and Africa, I've served three transport ministers in the Middle East, Krish, when I was at McKinsey. And you know, Agility, we're building out a lot of warehousing across the Middle East and Africa. There's been, again, a big build-out over here. Now, Jebel Ali, which is the visionary port that was built in Dubai by the ruler of Dubai, is one of the few non-Chinese ports in the world top 10 or top 11. I mean, the others being Singapore and Rotterdam. It's an incredible success, Jebel Ali port. Now, what has happened is that a lot of other Middle Eastern economies, flush with oil money, have said, we need to diversify our economies. And we need to build ports and airports and airlines that, you know, Dubai is an example. Why can't we do the same thing? So you've seen the build out in Abu Dhabi and Qatar and Saudi Arabia of large mega ports, but large airports and airlines, right? They call the Middle East big three, Emirates, Etihad, Qatar, and now Saudi Arabia is going to do the same thing. So I think the Middle East economies see transport infrastructure and the transport sector as a major engine of driving economic growth and GDP and diversifying their economies. Because once you have a big port, you're able to then have free zones around it, which can then attract businesses and manufacturing and trade, like Jebel Ali has very successfully done. When you have an airport, you have a lot of passengers flying through en route from, say, from India to Europe or India to the US, but they're encouraged to stop here and visit attractions in the city, which then drives tourism, which then drives hotels and amusement parks and a lot of other GDP diversification. So I've seen that happen in the Middle East. Now, the funny thing, obviously, is that people will say, hey, why do you need another big port 100 kilometers down the same coast? So there is a bit of that question. What's interesting now is that with so much disruption to global supply chains because of pirates off the coast, you know, a war or any sort of a ship getting stuck in a canal, it sometimes helps to have multiple routes through these emerging markets. Another theme that I've seen is also competition for African resources or for influence in emerging markets between the big powers, between China and the US. You have the great storyline behind the Belt and Road Initiative of China. But even if you think about the US, I mean, the copper mining area of Zambia that I grew up in is now getting so much press because the US is partly funding something called the Lobito Corridor, which is a rail corridor from the port of Lobito in Angola on the Atlantic into the Copper Belt. Whereas you have competing routes from Zambia to Tanzania, to Mozambique and to South Africa, and even further south, right? So it's fascinating that a lot of transport infrastructure into Africa is for resources, but it will have transformational impact on a lot of these economies. It's also interesting to see who is building these, who is building this transport infrastructure, right? Because it's players from a whole bunch of emerging markets. Yes, there's Maersk, which is the big Danish giant, but you have a player like DP World, which is the erstwhile Dubai Ports World, which is operating terminals in so many countries around the world, including across Africa. And you'll soon have Abu Dhabi and the Saudi port entities also building ports across Africa. So it's incredible to see all this transport infrastructure being built out in emerging markets. And I've seen this firsthand. I mean, across markets from Nigeria to Kenya to India to Saudi Arabia and UAE.
Wonderful, wonderful. One micro question on this is, you mentioned this, you know, tremendous incentive alignment that took place when India starts privatizing parts of its infrastructure by also being a shareholder in those concessions, right? I'm curious about, you also mentioned the forecasting kind of being undershot on the reality, kind of overshooting. That does that have a meaningful impact on returns in any manner, wherein people just kind of like misread the opportunity, and therefore the initial operators who took that risk were therefore, because just the growth was far larger than what they expected, they were able to kind of, you know, build real kind of high margin, high growth businesses that you know, just others mispriced.
Yeah, so there's several themes to that. You talked about the government being a shareholder in this. Now, this was very important because of political economy. You have to understand that in most, even in the developed world and the developing world, people look at infrastructure as a public good. The perception and the thought is that, hey, I'm a citizen of this country. As a public good, my government should be providing me with electricity, transport, water, garbage collection, right? So sometimes it becomes a problem for political economy for the public of a country to see, you know, profit-seeking private sector take on these assets. And that's why it's really important, even for political economy and public acceptance, for the government to be a shareholder and partner in this. Because if there's upside, if there are, you know, high returns, the government and the taxpayer are benefiting from that too. And similarly, if there's pain, the government is incentivized to ensure that the project works. So it's a nice alignment of incentives for that to happen. Now, the reality is, you talked about the returns. Krish, it's high risk, right? Unless it's a power concession agreement where you know what you're going to get in terms of power tariff and how much demand, a lot of these other assets, an airport or a transport infrastructure, is open to market risk, how much demand there's going to be. So what you can do in the concession agreement is some level of protection. You can say, hey, the government is not going to allow a second airport or a second port within this distance of the asset that I'm getting. But a lot of it is your own bet on that economy, your own bet on that country's currency. So there is a significant degree of risk. Now, obviously, it's higher for the initial projects. And after there's proof of concept, that changes a bit. But for some projects that take on that market risk, there is significant risk associated with it. And, you know, like I mentioned, sometimes land acquisition, there are huge delays in so many of these projects. Sometimes it's regulatory risk, because when we built out the first PPPs in these countries, what happened was we had to also set up a brand new regulator that would regulate the pricing and the tariffs, or how much you might charge the user of the airport, right? So there's also an element of regulatory risk there in each of these projects. So yeah, it's a interesting example of sharing in risk and reward between the government and the private sector. And, you know, the new models continue to emerge in the next, second, third generation PPPs that are being played out in India and other emerging markets.
Totally fascinating. I have far more, you know, questions on this front, but I think we'll leave those for another time. I'm curious about the other sector we kind of, you know, alluded to in terms of the broader themes that you've really built a deep kind of knowledge and practice with regards to. And that second sector is real estate. We're seeing a tremendous urbanization trend across the world. I'm curious, what are some of the most interesting projects that you've seen? And what do you think the opportunities and challenges that tend to kind of come alongside that as it relates to building out real estate in emerging markets?
There's a huge build out of real estate across different asset classes in the emerging markets. Urbanization is a big theme. And as people are getting richer and are moving to the big megacities, Cairo, Lagos, Mumbai, Calcutta, Karachi, there's enormous demand for residential real estate and by extension, offices, warehouses, and everything. And a lot of these cities were not planned for that kind of growth. I spent a decade in Bangalore, which has completely failed to keep up with the explosive demand for real estate. So I've worked on a lot of real estate projects, initially in India, mixed use developments. And then during my time at McKinsey, a lot of ambitious real estate projects in the Middle East. Because in the Middle East, again, as part of the theme of diversifying their economies, they have developed large new concepts for cities, which they're now building. They're also building out a lot of mixed-use developments. That means there's office, residential, and an integrated development. Because they're trying to increase their population and attract global talent to these cities. So they're trying to make these cities attractive from the real estate perspective in terms of high-quality living, high-quality offices, entertainment, etc. The biggest transformation I'm seeing has been in Saudi Arabia, where they have to they're trying to create these new cities. And they focused, I'll give you the example of NEOM. NEOM is a very ambitious project, which has been launched to be a city that attracts the world's best talent and some of the most exciting new projects to Saudi Arabia. They will have to compete with a city like Dubai, but also other global capitals to attract that talent. And I think, you know, there's one problem statement, which is how do we design this and how do we fund it? But I think the second problem statement, which is how to attract businesses to NEOM, right? And I think that's an easier question than the third problem statement, which is how do we get people to move here and live here and bring their families here to live here long term? So I've worked on several of these in the Middle East. It's been fascinating. And because a lot of it is coming to life now, and it'll be interesting to see how they work on the people attraction piece. So that, I think, will be the interesting thing to watch, particularly as Saudi Arabia. And maybe we'll come back to Saudi Arabia in the future, because that is a different story that I see playing out and I've seen play out over the last decade. I've spent the last 5 years, Krish, focusing and doubling down on one particular real estate asset class, which is logistics real estate, which is warehousing. Now, this is I joke that this was a deeply unsexy part of warehousing. A part of real estate, right? One likes to talk about central business district offices and beautiful hotels and beautiful apartments. Nobody's ever talked about warehouses. But Blackstone, warehousing has been the highest conviction theme for Blackstone over the last decade. It's been John Gray, who's the COO, it's been one of his biggest bets. And they've spent $100 billion on buying and building warehouses around the world. And we're seeing that in the emerging markets too, in India, in the Middle East, and Africa. And it's with the growth of e-commerce, with the growth of trade, warehousing has become a significant asset class. And I've spent the last 5 years figuring out where in these cities do we build large warehouse parks? How do we modernize warehousing? Because people in developing countries have been storing cargo and goods on the floor, but we're trying to get them to modernize and move to racks and using modern equipment. And that's been a challenge, across sub-Saharan Africa. So logistics real estate has been an exciting real estate asset class that I focused on for the last 5 years. If you know, there's another theme that I think is a big opportunity across the developing world. It's going to be affordable housing, Krish, because it's easier to build and price housing for the upper middle class, for the newly affluent in these in India, in Mumbai or in a Cairo or in a Johannesburg or in a Kenya. The tough challenge is getting affordable housing right, because it's going to take intervention from government and possibly to enable the private sector to bring solutions on the affordable housing front. You look at an example like Dharavi, the biggest slum in the world in Mumbai, and the redevelopment plan they have there, where they are partnering with a developer, the Adani Group, and they're giving them an incentive in another part of the city to go higher, which is higher floor to area ratio in other parts of the city, in order to be able to redevelop the slum area. So you're going to need very innovative models for affordable housing to meet the housing requirement of the bottom of the pyramid in all these mega cities in Africa and you know, South Asia and other developing markets. So I think that's a big opportunity and problem that we need to work on solving.
Fascinating. I'm curious, do you have any kind of specific take or opinion on the kind of Adani story as it relates to that kind of company being very much the kind of, you know, iconic poster child of being able to kind of shove through problems to make infrastructure happen in a place where, for example, you have land acquisition troubles, etc.?
So I think there are the one interesting difference between China and India has been that the China story, at least the one that's told to us, is mostly government-led, massive government corporations that are their national champions. India's story is different from China's in that you have very entrepreneurial local businesses. And there are many. There's the Tata Group. You know, Krish, when I was in the US in 2008, I met someone who had met a classmate who'd never heard of Tata. And I had to explain to them that Tata is a $110 billion Indian conglomerate that is the same size as Siemens, $110 billion. I Googled recently, Krish. Siemens is around about the same size still, 110, 120 billion. Tata is three times that size. They're 360 billion now, right? And they have businesses from Tata Tea, which bought Tetley. They have steel, they have software, they have hotels, the Taj Group. So there's big entrepreneurial conglomerates like Tata. There's Reliance, there's Birla, and there's the new upstart, which is Adani, which has done very well over the last decade. So I think it's a fascinating example of emerging market businesses that were winners at home in India and then went global and have done incredibly well on the global stage too. They've taken that entrepreneurial spirit. They've taken that famous Indian word called jugaad, which means figuring it out and getting past, problem solving essentially. And now they're doing it on the global stage. And of course, there are tech companies too. Infosys, Cognizant, Tata Consultancy Services. But there are many beyond Adani. And my favorite is Tata. So, and they just continue to grow.
Wonderful. On that kind of Indian word, one of my friend's favorite words is helmet, which means kind of courage, I think, if I'm not mistaken. I've probably mispronounced it, but yeah. In any case, so I'm curious, we were kind of digging into the kind of sub-asset classes of real estate. You spoke about warehousing. Would love to kind of dig deeper on data centers and digital infrastructure, especially given the AI-induced gold rush that is taking place right now within the sector. Is this happening within emerging markets too? Is there demand for localization? Which countries and players would you say are in the lead right now, and what is the kind of state of play here?
I definitely have seen and experienced this gold rush in data centers and digital infrastructure over the last few years. What's happened, Krish, is with the explosion of data consumption across developed markets, but also emerging markets, with increasing mobile phone usage, streaming apps like Netflix and similar types of apps, people are just consuming more data. So you need more data centers. Now, what used to happen is that the data center in Marseille would service the customer in an African country. now, because people need that data closer because of latency, because, I mean, you can't be streaming a Netflix movie in Lagos or in Nairobi, and if it's going to slow down, nobody's going to watch that movie on Netflix, right? So digital infrastructure in terms of cable infrastructure has exploded. There are many more. And there's a huge explosion in investment in data center in the Middle East, Africa, and India. And we've seen that because one of the areas that I identified while building out Agility strategy was data centers, because we had many data center operators come to us and say, hey, you guys are present across the Middle East and Africa. We'd love to figure out a way to partner with you guys. So we looked at this asset class, and there's a huge demand across the Middle East and Africa, but it's concentrated really only in a handful of countries, which is important from a business focus point of view. So in the Middle East, 80% of the action is in two countries, the UAE and Saudi Arabia. And 20% of the action is in the other four GCC countries, Oman, Qatar, Bahrain, and Kuwait. In Africa, the continent with 54 countries, most of the action is just in five countries, 80% in five countries. South Africa, which probably has 50% of all data center investment in the continent, as well as Kenya, Nigeria, Egypt, and Morocco. Now, there's sporadic, the odd data center in all the other countries, you know, in Ethiopia, in Cote d'Ivoire, in Angola, in some of these other countries. But I worry that a lot of countries are being left behind, Krish. And there's a growing digital divide between the countries that will have this digital infrastructure and those that won't. Because once you put on the service layers on the digital infrastructure, there are transformational things that run on this. There's mobile money. There's ed tech. There's healthcare applications that need to run on this for remote populations. So people that are not connected, rural populations or populations in landlocked countries, which are further away from the cable infrastructure, will get left behind. So I think the important thing is figuring out the policymakers need to figure out how they enable, make it easier for data center investors to find an attractive economic case to build in those countries. So that's, I mean, that's, you know, what we're seeing across these markets. The X factor that has played out in the last year or so, Krish, has been artificial intelligence. Because with the explosion of AI and ChatGPT, the usage of data is going to explode in these markets, which means that you're going to need more data center capacity quicker in these developing countries. I live in the UAE, where the UAE itself has been a first mover at the government level in investing in AI. They have a company called G42, which is fascinating because G42 is building the full stack. So they have a supercomputer. They're building their own Arabic large language model. They've partnered with OpenAI. They've partnered with NVIDIA to get the compute for the LLM, for their supercomputer. And they have a data center operator called Khazna, which is building data centers across the UAE, the Middle East, and Africa to be a national champion, similar to DP World, like I mentioned earlier, which is building ports across the world. G42 and Khazna will build data centers around the world and be a UAE national champion. So I think digital infrastructure and data centers is a capital-rich, talent-scarce sector. So for professionals who are looking at an asset class and a new opportunity, I think data centers will be very exciting, particularly in emerging markets, because there's no talent to build out these data centers, to figure out where to, how to, what the business case, et cetera, is. So if there's somebody out there who's up for a challenge, who wants to have real impact in the developing world, and who wants to position themselves for a white space that is going to be an incredible opportunity over a career, I would look at data centers and digital infrastructure.
Fantastic. Do you have any recommendations for those characters in terms of getting started?
I would start. I mean, there's a lot of online resources, but there are many different ways in which you can enter the data center space. If you're into construction, if you're in engineering, look at joining a data center player. If you're into leasing, look at entering a leasing business, leasing in data centers. If you're a software player, engineer, AI is going to be massive, right? And then if you're a strategy professional, whole bunch of strategy questions and problems that need to be solved in this entire space. And you need to be willing to travel and get your boots dirty in these emerging markets.
Always. That's, I think, part of the, as you mentioned at the very beginning, adventure and fun challenge that we intentionally take on. You mentioned a wonderful line in your previous answer, which was the continent of 54 countries. I think that's a nice segue to discussing that continent, which is in terms of your view, given what you've seen so far across those countries, right? What do you think the opportunity set is for global investors within some of those regions that you've worked in more broadly?
Yeah, sure. So a lot of people get stuck when they even just think about, okay, where do I even start in Africa? Now, depending on what business you're in, actually, irrespective of which business you're in, the single most important thing from a strategic point of view for Africa, Krish, is market selection. There are 54 countries in Africa, right? And if market size matters for you, if you're into consumption, if you're in a business where the size of the economy matters to you, there are only 5 or 6 countries that are more than 100 billion in GDP, Krish. It's Egypt, South Africa, Kenya, Algeria, Morocco, and Ethiopia. That's it. You know, a lot of the other countries that get some press are much, much smaller. You know, so the amount of effort that you might take in a country that that is one-tenth the size of Egypt or one-tenth the size of South Africa may not make sense, right? So I think a lot of companies get it wrong at the first step, which is market selection. So I think market selection is key. You have to select countries that have allow you the right scale to build a large platform, and then figure out what are the most important criteria within those countries. I'll give you an example, Krish. I mean, somebody was asking me, oh, should we set up a factory? We're thinking North Africa. We're thinking maybe Egypt, maybe Morocco. And there are just so many differences between both of them. They are both North Africa, and yes, they are both Arab and maybe majority Muslim, but that's where the similarities end, you know? One is Anglophone, one is Francophone. The Moroccan currency is pegged to the euro and dollar, so it's much more stable. Egypt's currency has devalued 50% in the last 12 months. Egypt is witnessing high inflation, challenges with their currency. They have a population of 110 million people. Morocco is very, very different. So each of these countries is just so different. And that's one of the issues in Africa that we have come to see, which is that your learning in one market doesn't necessarily translate to another. So what you've done well in Ghana, the lessons you've learned in Ghana might not be useful in the neighboring country of Côte d'Ivoire, which is a Francophone country, which has a different legal system and its own different sets of challenges. So market selection and the nuance between them is an important thing to understand. Then there's an entire slew of challenges, Krish, that you have to, again, live day to day. Because Murphy's Law strikes from land acquisition when it comes to our asset class, right? Anything to do with real assets, infrastructure, real estate, you have problems with land acquisition. Ensuring that the land title that you get actually belongs to the person who's selling it, and that it's not a fake title or that somebody else is claiming that land. Currency and currency devaluation, which is massive, especially when there are external shocks. Getting permits, operating in these markets, a whole bunch of challenges. So it's not something that building a business in Africa, you have to have a very, very strong ground game. And therefore, you need to have a very strong team on the ground. You need to enable them to take decisions and solve problems very quickly, because it can't be run out of, I don't know, a London or New York. It doesn't work that effectively. Even that team needs to be on the ground as much as possible, and the local team needs to be enabled. I spoke earlier about the power of relationships And again, relationships locally matter a lot. It sometimes helps to have a local partner who understands the market and is deeply trusted and well-respected in the market and has built some credibility in that country with the government and with the population. We have local partners in a couple of the markets that we're in, and they've enabled us to grow faster because we have complementary strengths that we've brought in those partnerships. So that's helped. So I think those are some of the things to do in Africa. Also, I'd say doing business in Africa, you need a level of humility when you're doing business in these markets, Krish, because people in Africa hate it when the foreigner comes and says, hey, this is the way it's got to be done. Hey, you know, I know how it's going to be done, right? Because no, I mean, yes, you have some idea of how it's worked in a developed country or in a different market, but you don't know how that's going to work in Nigeria or in Ethiopia, right? And so you have to have that humility when you're engaging with the local population, but even in terms of a mindset, because you're going to have a problem-solving mindset because Murphy's Law strikes all the time, but you're going to have that level of humility because you're like, oh my God, I don't know this and I need to learn.
Fascinating.
I hope I'm not scaring people away from investing in Africa. That's what happens. A lot of people tell me that you're scaring people away. I'm like, no, I'm not scaring them. I'm trying to be constructive so that it works out well or better than it would otherwise.
You're preparing them.
Yes.
I'd like to just narrow down a bit more on the relationships component. Do you have any frameworks in mind or any ways of thinking about how one can be tier A at that aspect? So just like, I'll give you two quick examples of kind of metaphors here, perhaps. So like one is like on the technology side. Affinity is this CRM, which has this term / concept known as relationship intelligence. And within that, they talk about kind of measuring the extent to which you are close to someone based on those kind of frequency of interactions, but also you can understand how close different organizations are as well, and therefore the flow of information between them, right? So that's like a good example of technology impacting the way in which you may conduct your relational kind of operations. Another perspective here is in terms of organizations and how they organize themselves. There's a great anecdote from CAA, the talent agency within which Michael Ovitz, during its early days and even now perhaps even, they would every single morning have shared notes process. So they'd say, who did you talk to? What did you learn? What's going on? And everyone knew everything about everyone. These are like, you know, fundamental kind of practices, which, you know, in the abstract, one can say relationships, but I feel like there's clearly a massive difference in being like tier A at relationships versus, you know, tier C. And I'm curious as to what the lessons have been within using that kind of tool.
Yeah, I mean, if I look at my career and you know, being someone from the developing world who's grown up in the developing world, who's doing business in the developing world, I think when it comes to relationships, one is fundamentally, you need to prioritize them and invest significant time and energy in building them. I think there are lots of businesses or approaches where they don't really bother enough in investing in building those relationships. They just want to cut to the chase and do business straight away. The second is building trust. The third is structuring a win-win, right? Now, I'll come back to the first one, which is the importance of relationships. Krish, the first time I did business in China, a colleague of mine from China coached me and a colleague saying, listen, when you go meet them, the first time you're introducing yourself, the second time you become friends, the third time is when you even discuss business. Right? Similarly, in a lot of these countries in the Middle East, the first time you're having a chai and you're talking about your family, you're talking about what your kid does, you're talking about everything but business, because you're building you're building affinity and you're building that trust with that person. Because it can't be transactional. The emerging markets have to be relationship-based and less transactional, because as I mentioned earlier, the contract is a piece of paper that you sign one day. But with all the challenges that happen every day after that, you only solve them through relationships. So trust is a big thing that you need to build. And you need to do this in person. you have to travel to Cairo or to Casablanca or meet the people in person and build those relationships. You can't do this over Zoom from New York or London or Dubai. You have to get on the ground and build those relationships, go out into the field together, eat together, and really build trust. Because trust is the critical commodity that keeps compounding in these developing markets, Krish. Because once somebody trusts you, they tell somebody else, and they tell somebody else. And here's the flip side of that coin, Krish, because once somebody has broken that trust, that reputation matters so much, right? Because then everybody hears that you screwed over somebody, because it's such a relationship-driven market. You know, so I was once in a business meeting with a CEO in Australia, and he said the joke for doing business in India is that it's like swimming in the Ganges. You're always going to get a bit dirty unless your business partner is the Tatas, right? And that speaks to the reputation, the spotless reputation that the Tatas have. And so whenever you go into any country, Krish, you can ask people, right? I mean, tell me about that businessman. And people on the street will have stories. Oh, that person, he's a crook. Or that person, oh gosh. Or that person is incredible. An upstanding citizen they do good for the society and he's an honest person, etc. So trust is the other important, very, very important thing to build. The third thing I'd say is structuring a win-win relationship, right? Because it can't be a zero-sum game. You know, similar to the public-private partnership philosophy I'd articulated earlier, with your local partner, you both need to have skin in the game. And if things go well, you both need to win. And if things go south, then you both lose. If it's not structured that way, Krish, then that relationship is not a fair one, right? Because sometimes we think of negotiation in that I need to win and the counterparty needs to lose. No, in emerging markets, for a sustainable business, you have to structure more win-win relationships, even if that means giving up some value in that discussion. Because there's no point me squeezing everything out of this person in the first negotiation. And at the first sign of trouble, the local partner is like, hey, there's not much for me to gain from this anyway. You know, hey, let's give up, right? So, I think that would be my take, that relationships matter so much and you need to invest great energy and time in building them. And trust is the single most important trust which leads to reputation. And the third thing is making sure it's a win-win.
Fantastic. One final thing I want to kind of cite on this particular topic of relationships and trust is I've really enjoyed your LinkedIn posts, for example, but I know there's some other characters as well. There's this guy called Slava who built a digital healthcare company in Russia. I think it was one of the biggest ones there. He's moved to Nigeria now, and he's been posting about his journey in Nigeria as he's aiming to build some sort of healthcare, health tech play in the region. And trust, as you mentioned, is like a one-to-one thing, but it's also a one-to-many thing. And it's been fascinating to see his journey of kind of through sharing kind of those lessons, the compounding in inflow and inbound kind of trust-based relationship stuff that's kind of happened. Now, moving on to the deep dive of these regions, we're talking about Africa. You have spent a lot of time in the Middle East. The Middle East is probably one of the most exciting stories from the last 20, 30 years as it relates to emerging markets. It's been at the epicenter of this huge transformation in kind of capital allocation. I think the best example here recently has been the Egypt deal that's taken place with one of the countries there where they've kind of bought a massive chunk of land. Could you walk us through some of the opportunities that you're most excited about within the Middle East region?
Sure, Krish. So I moved to Dubai from New York in 2013. And I like to say that I was moving from an old world capital, which is what I call New York and London, to a new world capital, which is what I call places like Dubai and Singapore. And over the last 11 years, since 2013, I've seen such a massive transformation in this region, Krish. And a lot of people have perceptions about the Middle East, which are really very far from the reality, or the region is changing so quickly that one needs to come here in person to update that reality, right? Their understanding of this region. So maybe I'll deep dive on two specific markets that I've lived in the most, which is the UAE, and the market that I've done a huge amount of work in, which is Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, Krish, when I came in 2013, there were no women in any office, in any workplace. They were barely visible if you did business, right? You'd have restaurants with two different entrances, one for families and one for single men. You'd have religious police making sure that man and woman who aren't related weren't walking together in the mall. So there's been a, and the big drivers of the economy were oil, Aramco, SABIC, which is chemicals, and Ma'aden, which is mining. With the advent of the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, and his ascent into power, he has fundamentally changed that country over the last decade, Krish. He launched an ambitious program called Vision 2030, which was going to dramatically diversify the economy and modernize the society. And it's happened at breakneck speed. On the society front, women are now everywhere in the economy. They are working, they have, they're part of society. All those restrictions on restaurants and other things have changed dramatically. Now, when I land in Riyadh, often the passport officer is a Saudi woman, right? When I check in to fly back out of Saudi, it's sometimes a Saudi woman at the counter, right? And there's Saudi professionals, ambitious young Saudi women. Women are driving, so that society is transformed fundamentally, which is fantastic because they've unlocked human potential of half their population, right? Which is women, which is an incredible story. On the economic side, the big impetus behind Vision 2030 was to diversify the economy because they couldn't just rely on resources. So what they're trying to do is pour money into diversifying the economy, into building a lot of projects, large tourist projects. They're blessed with a spectacular coastline on the Red Sea. So what Egypt has with Sharm el-Sheikh and Hurghada, Saudi Arabia can build this easily. And that's what they're doing with the Red Sea project. They're building the new city, Neom, because they want to have a clean sheet of paper and build a world-class city. They are investing in a new airline. They're investing in new ports. They have opened up hundreds of cinemas that didn't exist 10 years back when I came to the region, Krish. So if you're in the entertainment business, it's a massive new market. Because what they realized was that their Saudi population was going outside. They were going to Dubai or they're going to Europe and they're spending a fortune on entertainment and tourism. So this was low-hanging fruit, that why don't we get our own population to invest in tourism in the country. The other big tourism segment is religious tourists. Because you have Mecca and Medina, you have a large global population coming to Saudi Arabia for as religious tourists. Now, their primary reason is coming for the Hajj or Umrah, but they can stay on and they can visit other sites. They can also invest in local real estate. I mean, it's a massive opportunity, right? If you build high quality real estate in any of these cities, there is a huge ocean of wealthy Muslims who would love to own a second home or a second apartment in the Holy Land for them. So Saudi Arabia is also, Krish, I think Saudi Arabia is the world's largest construction market now. I mean, there are many numbers out there, but there's a number that's a $1 trillion construction market. So if you are doing anything in the construction value chain, project management, you're an architect, you're a construction company, Saudi Arabia is an opportunity for at least the next decade. Because in 2030, Riyadh will host the World Expo. And in 2034, they will host the World Cup. So they're in a construction super cycle, an investment super cycle, at least for the next 10 years. not just till 2030, which is Vision 2030, but at least till 2034 when they have the World Cup. And Krish, as part of that, there's going to be Outbound too. They're hosting the World Cup. So they are going to invest like the UAE and Qatar did in sports as an asset class. You know, they're going to invest in owning teams. They're going to invest in branding Saudi Arabia across the world to attract tourists to this market. So Saudi Arabia is an incredible opportunity and one that people have to understand. And again, you have to come here. Everybody that I know who has come to Saudi Arabia has said that their perception has changed because it's like nothing they expected, right?
So moving on to the next region within the Middle East, apart from Saudi Arabia, what are some of the other countries that you have developed a specific thesis on right now?
Krishna, so I moved to Dubai in 2013 and I've now been here 11 years and I've done work here and I've lived here. And this is one of the most exciting places in the world because Dubai is an emirate, one of the seven emirates of the UAE. Now, it had less oil than, say, Abu Dhabi, which is the capital, and some of the surrounding economies like Qatar, Saudi Arabia, etc. So they were the first to realize the importance of diversifying. And now, with the incredible vision of the ruler, Krish, they have a large port in Jebel Ali, which is one of the world's top 12 ports, which is an engine for trade. And then they have a free zone attached to it, which again has, which is the regional distribution hub for the region. They have trade finance associated with that. They're also, they have the large airline Emirates, which is one of the world's biggest airlines, and Dubai Airport, which has therefore funneled in tourists into the market, and they've developed a range of attractions along their beaches to make it a wonderful place. So it's one of the world's top five most visited cities, and they've made it the financial hub for the Middle East and Africa. So they have a financial center in the DIFC, the Dubai International Financial Center, which has a whole slew of financial institutions, hedge funds, crypto companies, and that's where they're headquartered. And what's increasingly happening is that the Middle East and Africa headquarters for large multinationals is now being set up in Dubai because it's the best place to be if you want to run Africa because you have the most flight connectivity. You're able to attract global talent quite easily from a visa, from an immigration perspective, and it's a safe place where talent would love to be based and have their families also live and their kids go to school. That's been the case for me, right? Because me and my wife both work, our kids go to school here, and we're very happy. So Dubai is a shining new world capital. And I think its influence is just going to grow as the emerging markets grow. Now, Abu Dhabi probably started a bit later, but it's the richer, wealthier capital city. And they have tried to, in a similar vein, replicate a lot of what has worked in Dubai. They have a large port, they have a large airport, an airline, and they are trying to become a hub for new businesses, particularly in hedge funds and a lot of other financial services. Given the enormous amount of capital that exists in this region, in Abu Dhabi and Saudi Arabia. So I'm very bullish on the UAE, Krish, and it's a very global place. So it's 80%+ expatriate in Dubai, which means that my kid, who's out of 20 in her class, there are probably 15 different nationalities. When I moved from McKinsey in the US to McKinsey in Dubai, Krish, we had 300 consultants from 65 countries. So it's such an international place, which is exciting from doing business, from living, from food, from everything. So I'm long-term bullish on the UAE and Dubai in particular.
Fantastic. Now, final region that we'll touch upon here. I was in India last month for the first time in like a decade, and it was fascinating to see, you know, on the one hand, the energy around transformation, on the other hand, you know, fundamental flaws that remain in the region. What are your thoughts on, you know, India as the world's fifth largest economy that is on a narrative and economic tear right now?
So, Krish, I think we need a whole new episode to cover, to even even scratch the surface of India. And, you know, it's funny, Krish, because I don't think most people outside India understand India. I mean, I think you need a 101 or an India for Dummies book, because there's just such limited understanding of India. And how that's manifested itself is funny. So, for example, Krish, I lived in the US for 5 years, and people would ask me, what's your real Indian name? And I'd say, well, my real Indian name is Ronald Jesse Philip. And they say, is it, but is that, you know, your American version of Raj Patel or whatever? I'd say, no, it's really Ronald Philip. And then I'd have this one minute elevator pitch explaining why my name was there, which was saying that out of a population of 1.3 billion, we had a majority of Hindus, yes, right? 800 million Hindus. But we had 300 million Muslims, the second biggest Muslim population in the world after Indonesia. We had 30 million Christians, and I'm from that community. We had Jews, we had Buddhists, we had Jains, and we spoke all these different languages, and each of these regions was different, right? So there's such an enormous eclectic diversity across India, which I don't think most people in the rest of the world understand. So India is a massive economic opportunity, right? And I think most Western businesses are now increasingly comfortable with it. It's helped. Language, I think, has helped versus, say, China, right? And the fact that the Indian diaspora, Krish, I think has been the bridge between the rest of the world and India. Now, India... you need a very strong ground game and a very strong management team that has the right strategy. Because even within the new, within each of these sectors, Krish, you have incredible success stories and incredible failures. In the car automotive sector, you have somebody like Hyundai, the Koreans, who are going to launch a $300 billion IPO just for their Indian business.
Wow.
Their global business is valued at 450. So imagine their India business is more than half the global business. And you contrast that with an American automaker like Ford, which had to exit India, which just could not figure out India. So I think a key part of getting India right is having an India strategy that is uniquely for India. You can't replicate the China strategy in India. You can't replicate any other strategy in India. It has to be unique to India. I think you have to build a unique strategy, a unique value proposition, a unique product for India. You take the example of McDonald's, Krish. Go into a McDonald's in Delhi or Bombay, you will not recognize anything on that menu versus the McDonald's that you have in Times Square or in Trafalgar Square in London or whatever, right? You have a Mac Alu Tikki burger. There is no beef burger on the menu in McDonald's in India. And they have nailed it. The price point, the product, they have nailed it and they've done well. But so many people don't, right? The other perception that some people sometimes have, which we alluded to earlier, is India is an entrepreneurial private sector economy. So you have so much entrepreneurial energy, which manifests itself, yes, in the large Indian conglomerates like the Tatas, the Reliances, Birlas, and more recently, again, Adani. But in every sector, you have Indian businesses. India has the third largest number of unicorns after the US, which has 600, China 300, and India over 100 right now. You know, in my parents' generation, Krish, people would either, if they wanted a safe job, they'd go into government service. Right. Or, I mean, if you're from certain societies, you'd get into a business. But government service. Then in my generation, it was IT. You know, you'd want to work with an Infosys or a Wipro or somebody. Or you want to be a chartered accountant, a doctor or an engineer. Now, everyone has the license. A middle class kid has the license to go and try doing a startup. or to join a startup, or to launch his own startup, right? Which is a transformational change in that society. So it's very exciting. The number of the middle class, over 100 million people are in the middle class. That means the consumption locally and internationally is going to be a huge opportunity. Whatever you're selling, whether it's mobile phones, whether it's TVs, whether it's luxury cars, all that consumption, there is no middle class that's growing as quickly as India's. Maybe China's, but after China, it's really India. And that's an opportunity for the rest of the world too. Krish, I live in Dubai, where the number one buyers of real estate in Dubai have been India for all of the last 5 years, except last year when it was the Russians, when the Russians came. But Indians are the biggest purchasers of real estate in India. Indians are the biggest source market for Emirates Airlines. They are the biggest number of five-star hotel nights in Dubai. So anybody who gets this Indian segment right abroad, it's a massive opportunity for them. I keep saying that if the EU made it easier for Indians to get the Schengen visa, the tourism GDP for Europe would explode, right? But it's a nightmare getting a Schengen visa, right? And they make it so difficult to get the visa. So you have this rising middle class. The talent pool, hundreds and thousands of people graduating from the engineering colleges, which has led to the IT boom. But now other asset classes too, right? I mean, there's such a huge talent pool, and the aspiration level in India has always been high. And it manifests itself in the energy. But there's, you know, my parents, my dad grew up in a village, and he then studied accounting, and then he traveled to Africa. My mom grew up in a one-bedroom apartment, got a scholarship from the Tatas to go to medical school, became a doctor. So the mobility in India has always been there for people who are willing to work hard. And education and entrepreneurship are now the two big drivers of social mobility. We believe as a society that you can have mobility if you work hard and study hard, and if you're an entrepreneur, which is really exciting. So it's a big opportunity. And I think we need another episode to do justice to it. But again, for people who haven't understood the opportunity, I would start with a visit. Maybe start as a tourist. Go to Kerala, which is gorgeous. Or go to Rajasthan. Go see the Taj Mahal, or go to Goa. Go see these cities. And the thing is, in the best business schools abroad, in the best engineering schools abroad, there are so many Indian students there. Maybe a first step is building friendships with them, right? And then they become your bridge to doing business in India, which I think is going to be one of the world. It's going to be the world. You said it's the world's fifth biggest economy. It's going to move to become the third, because it's going to overtake Germany and Japan.
Fascinating. I mean, one of the things you mentioned there is, you know, the McDonald's case, where they kind of got the right type of pricing points, they got the right type of product mix, they had that kind of cultural tailoring to the region. If we're talking shop here, we're talking about the nature of strategy in emerging markets. Obviously, you've been with tier A firms working on strategy. What would you say some of the most pertinent and top lessons have been as it relates to building a successful strategy for emerging markets? And, you know, within limits, obviously, if you could share some examples or external case studies, perhaps, would love to kind of like have that as some sort of your grounding for those lessons.
Yeah. So over the last, most of my career, for a large chunk of my career, I worked as a strategy advisor. I was a consultant, right, at McKinsey, and previously at PwC, where I was advising clients. And then over the last 5 years, I have had to develop the strategy, but put it into action too. And that's been the more interesting piece, because what happens with the strategy in emerging markets is that, one, you don't have much information. You don't have much data. So you have to get on the ground and get your own data and have hundreds of conversations which develop your own unique perspective, because there is no data, Krish. There aren't 100 listed companies that have their annual reports out there, right? So what I've done is I have been on the ground in 8 African countries, 4 Middle Eastern countries, and various Indian cities, going and seeing what's happening on the ground. having hundreds of conversations. An efficient way to do this is to go for conferences. So I go to the conference in Lagos, and over the course of 3 days, I'll have 50 meetings, right? Formal meetings, informal conversations, where I'll ask somebody, hey, how does it work? What happened? What's the real story? Right? And you get those, from those conversations, you develop a unique perspective that doesn't exist and isn't easily out there in a McKinsey report, or anything else. You have to get on the ground and develop it. You have to constantly develop it. The other important thing for strategy in emerging markets is you can't develop a static strategy. Like this is, here's our 5-year strategy. We're going to do this over the next 5 years. Because your circumstances change every 6 months. Egypt, where we're doing business, because of the Russia-Ukraine war, they got impacted. We were doing very well there. Suddenly we got whacked with currency devaluations, the economy, inflation, the interest rate doubled for some of our loans, right? So therefore you need to change strategy. You need to update and refresh strategy every 6 to 12 months, which is what I've been doing. Suddenly a country, sometimes an election, Krish, can change a country from unattractive to attractive, or vice versa. Sometimes a natural event can do that. But which brings me to another important point for emerging markets. You have to have multiple horses in the race. Because if you have a single bet, the concentration of risk is very, very high. So where possible, if you have an Africa strategy, sometimes it helps to have, instead of doubling down on maybe one or two, see if you can do four. Because what happens in these markets is that one of your horses might not even start, because it might take 3 years for you to get the land. Or something might go wrong terribly that completely kills that project, right? So what I've learned from our business and from many examples in these emerging markets is you need to have multiple horses in these emerging markets, multiple things to diversify some of that risk. And you need to be a bit opportunistic also. I gave you the example, we're a logistics real estate player, and we decided to launch a data center value proposition because that happened in the last couple of years. Was that there in a strategy that I would have developed in 2019 or 2020? No, but we had to allow for enough flexibility to allow a bit of an opportunistic play too. So directionally, we're clear that we want to build a large business in Africa, the Middle East, and India, and primarily in logistics, in X space. But if something comes up at the periphery, which is an adjacent space that we think we have a unique advantage in, that helps too. Mm-hmm. I think the other important piece to strategy is organization structure, incentives, and talent. It's very important that your organization structure is clearly delineated so that people have very clear mandates over specific parts of the business, that they are empowered and that they're incentivized, Krish. Because if someone isn't incentivized, it's really, really hard work doing business in emerging markets and doing business in Africa. So I always say that you need to get somebody who's mission driven, who has a real reason why they sign up to do this rather than have a much easier life and career in London or New York. And if they have skin in the game, then you know that they're going to be they're going to be calibrated in the decisions that they take. If they will share in the upside, they're much more likely to really push themselves and try and build real value. So that, strategy is really important. You need to go on the ground. You need to get involved with the business leaders as a partner in building that out. You need to keep changing and updating and refreshing your strategy as external and internal conditions change. You need multiple horses, so it needs to be diversified. And the organization structure, the talent that you attract, and the incentives need to be really thought out well. Another important piece on the talent, what happens with talent is that people don't work hard enough on getting the best local talent. You know, it's a bit lazy sometimes for a business from country X to enter, say, a region like Africa and just use country heads who are from the home country. I find that very lazy, and it doesn't really help them professionally and in terms of creating value. I think it's really important to find talent that is from these markets. And you'll find them. You might find them in New York, London, get them back, or in the markets themselves, and bring them on board, get them into the culture, ramp them up very quickly. But they are committed to these regions, right? They are from these markets. They have local relationships, local knowledge that the expat who flies in for a 3-year term does not have and will take much, much longer building. So I think local talent is key. One of the important things that we have done is that all our country managers are from the country, and they have deep local expertise, deep relationships, and they understand how to get business done and what works in each of these markets.
Fantastic. One thing you mentioned there was the kind of diversification component, right? Having multiple horses in the game, so to speak. You also mentioned organizational incentives as it relates to sharing the upside. And the intersection of those two that came to mind is, I think the most diversified model for building businesses is actually accelerators, like Y Combinator. And I feel like I've seen a couple of potential plays here where folks have worked on this. I think Rocket Internet, to a certain degree, was like an incubator where they worked on many projects across regions in the digital tech space. You have Seed Stars, which is working on some of this stuff as well. But I feel like that's like a very much an underrated vehicle to potentially explore there. Another note that I jotted down, which I quite liked, was you spoke about these adjacent opportunities. One of my favorite essays is entitled The Opportunity Next Door. And it talks about how some fabulously large businesses did not start in the market that made them fabulously large. Instead, they started within a market that allowed them to develop a core competency and then capitalize on the next thing afterwards. So I think there's some lessons that I'll be trying to integrate myself as I kind of, you know, make decisions on a daily basis. I'm wondering, let's think less about kind of corporate strategy now and more kind of like individual strategy for the adventurers / potential entrepreneurs, builders, etc., who want to dedicate their careers to emerging markets. What advice would you give to young students who are keen to go on a kind of similar journey where they get to interact with, you know, so many regions, so many types of people, and do fundamentally, you know, purposeful and impact-driven work?
Yeah, this is a personal passion of mine, Krish. I am very keen to inform and inspire many more people to focus their careers and their life's missions on emerging markets and the developing world. And particularly, Krish, people from the developing world, right? The smart kid in Lagos or in Harare or in Chingolo, where I grew up, wants to have a career in emerging markets. I'm really keen to help. Now, if there's some common threads that I've seen that help, are it makes a step function change in opportunity and possibility by education. If you go to a top school, now often, unfortunately, these are in the Western world, in the US or in the UK, ideally through a scholarship, they're increasingly more scholarships, right? That helps because that fundamentally changes your opportunity set. Because a lot of top global companies recruit at these top schools, and the Zimbabwean or the Zambian or the Ivorian lady that they hire in New York for Goldman Sachs, etc., builds that toolkit. And then when that person comes to Africa, they have, you know, that they've built that toolkit in the developed world. They have the passion to have impact in the developing world back in their home countries. And they have the relationships and they know the language. And that is a killer combination. Or if you are able to join the office, if you're the top student in your school in South Africa, University of Cape Town, and you get into the office of a top company like McKinsey or Bain BCG, that's transformational because that gives you exposure to work across emerging markets, not just thing. And these are international firms with a huge amount of mobility across the regions. So if you join a Goldman Sachs in Johannesburg or a McKinsey in Casablanca, if you're joining the McKinsey office in Casablanca, the exposure that you get at an early age is a stage in your career is transformational. So it really helps to, where possible, do well at school, if possible, in your country, and then a top school abroad, because that gives you the opportunity to work in some of the world's best companies, and then it's then an easier pathway into some of the top emerging market opportunities. That is a pathway. I'd say to build the cultural fluency to operate well in emerging markets, I always say that to enjoy it, you really have to love the culture and the people from these countries. I grew up in Zambia and in India, and I've been to many African countries. I love African culture. I love African sport. I love African food. I love African people. So when I was in graduate school in the US, I'd make friends with all the African. And this is natural. It wasn't because I had a business objective, right? But I always tell people who have aspirations to work in the developing world, hey, maybe why don't you start at your grad school? Go make friends with the Ghanaian student who is nothing like you, right? They might have completely different interests. They might have a different accent. They might have a favorite food. But go build relationships with them, right? Understand and be able to engage with them, because that will improve your the ability to build relationships in these emerging markets, right? Krish, I mean, I sometimes struggle when I'm having conversation with somebody who's never done business in India or the developing world, and we're making that conversation, right, over a meal and it's just me asking the questions. Oh, where are you from in France or UK or America? Oh, I love this baseball team, or I New York, etc. Whereas they don't have they don't ask any questions about India or tell me where you're from. There's no curiosity, and therefore they're not able to effectively build a relationship with me. It's almost one way. It's a one-way conversation. So I tell people, it's important if you want to be effective in emerging markets to build that muscle, to build relationships. And you do that by having curiosity about people, right? Your colleague from Thailand in the office in London, say, hey, listen, I mean, this weekend, should we go out to the best Thai restaurant that you recommend? And I'm going there for a holiday. I'm considering going there for a holiday with my folks. What are the top three things you recommend? Or I'm fascinated, what's your what's the religious makeup in that country, and how does that influence politics? Just ask questions, right? The last thing I think for developing markets and emerging markets is to be successful long-term, you have to be purpose-driven. You have to really believe that impact has to drive you, because it's not easy. And if you're just in it for the money, then that won't be enough. Ideally, it's purpose with profit. I think it's absolutely fine to want to do well financially, but the holy grail for me for a successful emerging markets career is the intersection of profit and purpose. If you're able to have both of those, that I want to do well in terms of impact and I want to do well, you know, economically, those two are very closely aligned. If you will have impact, then the economics works out in a lot of cases.
I love that. Okay, two final questions before wrapping this up. So we, in many respects, are a part of the Indian diaspora, and you've spent, you know, the majority of your life, you've interacted with a lot of folks who are a part of that, especially on the kind of business side of things. I'm curious what that experience has been like and what some of the main lessons have been from kind of jotting down. For example, you know, I was speaking to someone the other day, and she was talking about how she was shocked at just how many Indian-run businesses there are in South Africa, for example. I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so we are part of what is the world's largest diaspora, which is the Indian diaspora. But even within that, there are so many different strains. We talk about the Indian diaspora in Africa. Depending on which parts of India one came from, there were more common types of jobs that one would take. So I'm stereotyping and typecasting communities here, but often the Gujaratis would be very entrepreneurial and they'd be more likely to set up businesses across, especially East Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, even Zambia, where I grew up. In our telephone directory in Chingola, a small copper mining township, we had two entire pages of Patel, and they were the great entrepreneurs. They were the great entrepreneurs, you know, of across Africa. Whereas from South India, you may have had more teachers, doctors, engineers, accountants, right? So there are different strains. And across these African countries, Mauritius, for example, has a different strain of people from India versus Durban versus East Africa. So there's a huge diaspora. And there is an affinity and attachment with India. And in many respects, it's India's soft power. It's India's soft power abroad, and it's a bridge between the rest of the world and India. And I think it's an incredible subculture around the world, right? The third generation Indian American will still have, look at Rishi Sunak. Right, you have a Diwali celebration at 10 Downing Street because Rishi Sunak was born in the UK with parents who lived in Kenya, whose grandparents came from Gujarat. That culture has now influenced 10 Downing Street, right? And you look at the highest number of non-home country CEOs, Krish, are from India. The CEOs of Google, Microsoft, an entire spectrum of companies, banks, Louis Vuitton, Chanel, Lina Nair, right? It's changing the world in many ways that we can understand and we haven't yet understood right now. You never expected the Google CEO to have the accent. You never expected him to have the name Sundar Pichai. You never expected him to have the accent that he does. You never expected... I started my career with the World Bank in 2001, Krish. And I always thought... the World Bank president at the time was Jim Wolfensohn, right? Mm-hmm. And I could have never, ever imagined that a World Bank president would be somebody called Ajay Banga, who's a man with a turban and a beard, who's a Sikh. I could have never fathomed that. But that is how the world is changing. And I'd say companies and countries that seize this opportunity, the changing India, will do well. I think Dubai has understood this and is benefiting from a huge Indian diaspora here, from a huge affinity with India, and it's been an economic driver for Dubai. I think Saudi Arabia should look at India more and not just the West and the rest of the world, because if they focused on building the cultural and business ties with India that the UAE has done, I think it's an extra engine of growth for them. So I think the diaspora is fascinating and its impacts on the world and India's soft power and India's inevitable rise, we should watch out for it.
Wonderful. I appreciate that. Final question. I noticed that you've made quite a few angel investments within emerging markets and within kind of, you know, areas of core competency, etc. What would you say the main lessons have been from those angel investments? And what are you looking forward to as a thesis in the longer term, such that maybe if a listener is building, you know, the next great company, they can kind of share that with you?
So I only recently started angel investing because as part of my day job, running around all these developing countries, I would meet, there are tons of problems that we'd see and we'd sometimes get exposed because I have friends and relationships in all these markets, to entrepreneurs in these markets. So I started investing and then met a lot of founders. And in some instances, I even got involved as an advisor to some of these startups, particularly in areas that I had some expertise or knowledge or relationships in. And it was a bit sobering because it is incredibly hard, Krish, to build a business in emerging markets. Now, for something like, which is maybe fintech or something that is tech first, that is a bit easier than trying to build a tech solution, even in logistics, where you still have to use the real world. Because the amount of challenges that you have all the time that you don't have to face in the US or in a Germany or in a developed world are enormous. So it is very sobering for me in understanding that picking your market matters a lot there too. Because I'd often meet startup founders who are playing in a very small market. Because, you know, one of the big things that people pitch to you in these startup decks is TAM, total addressable market, right? And the funny thing is that somebody in an African country would put a McKinsey slide saying that the TAM for all of Africa was X billion. And I'd say, hey, I do business in Africa. Your TAM is not that number. Because I want to understand, how are you going to even go from your country? What's the next country you're going to choose? What are the next four? And they didn't know, right? And they're like, okay, so what's your playbook for Lagos? And how is that different from what you're doing in Johannesburg right now? Because it has to be different. It can't be the same. So it was a bit sobering because it's very hard to do. The operating model needs to change dramatically. And getting funding is still very, very, very hard, Krish, because I've been on many calls, sometimes as an investor, but sometimes, and you know, with the startup that I'm helping as an advisor, and there is a growing number, but not enough investors in these markets who have deep understanding and conviction on these markets and what the opportunity and what the solution can be. They need to hear that, oh, this is the Netflix of Kenya, or this is the Uber of Kenya, or I'm going to be the US startup of this country. Where, you know, I mean, maybe that might not be the right thing to do. Maybe Kenya needs a unique solution. M-Pesa was a unique solution. What were you going to ever describe M-Pesa as? Right? Because M-Pesa is M-Pesa. It's a unique solution for that unique market context. And sometimes founders, they do the mistake of trying to copy paste something that's worked in the West and apply it to a developing market, and it's a hammer looking for a nail. So I'm still in my learning journey when it comes to that, Krish. As an angel investor, I once contemplated, do I launch my own startup? But to be honest, I saw how hard it was, and I was like, oh my God, you know, I only have X amount of energy, and you know, I don't have the energy to do this at my stage in life and with my kids and whatever. I want to prioritize my kids too. So it's hard work, but I think that it is another form of value creation and economic activity and GDP creation in these markets that didn't exist some time back. And it's only going to grow. So I'm quite excited about it. And I hope to continue learning and investing and playing a part in the startup ecosystem, in the developing world, particularly in Africa, the Middle East, and India.
Fantastic. Any final words before we wrap up this episode and conversation?
I've really enjoyed the conversation. I really hope that many more people who want to have adventure and a life and career that marries adventure with impact, with solving problems, look at careers in Africa, the Middle East, and India. And I'm happy to speak to anyone who's at that stage in life and considering that, because I want to be helpful and mentor people who are purpose-driven and want to have impact in the developing world. So thank you so much for this opportunity, Krish. I really appreciate it.
Wonderful. I've learned an immense amount and look forward to continuing the conversation in the future, perhaps that India episode or even a series, given that India is so large.
We'll need an entire series for that. Yes.
Yeah. All right, cool. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.